this is Common Ground. While we hear little good news about Africa, South Africa being the exception, we'll get a little more balanced perspective on this edition of Common Ground about where Africa still has some major problems, but also where things are going right.
But you have governments in the African continent that are mendacious and completely unappreciating, people that rule by the gun and by intimidation, and, you know, who are basically looking after themselves. Having said that, let me say this, that again, every picture of gloom in Africa must be counterbalanced with what is going right.
Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. My guest Michael Chege is currently completing a book on democratization and political change in Africa. He spent the past year as a visiting senior research fellow at Harvard Center for International Affairs, and now he's returned to Africa to direct the Africa Capacity Building Foundation in Harare, Zimbabwe. A native of Kenya, Chege had high hopes for Africa once the Cold War ended, which he wrote about in an article for Foreign Affairs a few years ago. I asked Chege his assessment of Africa now that we're midway through this decade.
No, I think sadly, what has happened to Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, after the end of the Cold War has been, in general, a turn for the worse. But I should add almost immediately that there have been some very positive developments taking place at the same time. What has gone wrong? It's Somalia, it's Rwanda, it is the dictators who have defied international opinion in Kenya, in Zaire, and in Cameroon and Togo and countries like those. It is the continuing civil wars in Angola and in Liberia, etc., and Sierra Leone now. But we cannot fail to ignore what's going right either. It is South Africa and the magnificent and sterling leadership of Nelson Mandela in transcending the confines of hatred and apartheid and racism and inequality, and bringing in a government that represents all the communities, playing down his own personal suffering over the years, not wanting to retaliate. There are cases in which democracy and decent governance has been returned, and the people have elected leadership that is promising in Malawi, in Mozambique, you know, after the end of a vicious and long war. And you're seeing a government that is democratic in countries like Zambia and Benin. And there are countries like Botswana, which have been stable for many years. All these are good things happening in Africa, which are just as important as the things have gone wrong, that have gone wrong. And you have to balance the two and ask yourself, what is the trend of the future?
You mentioned that in South Africa, we have sort of a model of reconciliation and national governance that could be important, very important for the rest of the continent. Are there other things going on within South Africa that you see as models for the rest of the continent?
Yes, quite apart from the wonderful leadership that one sees in that country, not just in Nelson Mandela, but also in a whole generation of leaders, Bishop Desmond Tutu and Govan Mbeki, and some of the younger leaders who have come on board, there is the important lesson we are seeing now that the old generation of leaders in that country are already grooming their successors. And talking about Nelson Mandela himself has said he does not intend to run for presidency in the next election. They're getting younger people on the scene, grooming them, training them, giving them responsibility. Whereas in many African countries, the older leadership have clung onto power for just too long. That is one thing. The second factor that you want to look at, which I think provides a good model, a good lesson for African countries, is economic management. The government has refused to be drawn into populist, free spending, wheeling and dealing kind of expenditure of public finances, which one sees, practiced as plain license in a whole lot of other African countries. Government has to be prudent even on the face of, evidently, very strong and justified demands for services and for all kinds of needs for the people, especially the poor people. They're being very, very careful about not ruining that economy. And although there's a downside to this, because the people, especially the Africans, the blacks, expected much, much more than they're getting out of this. Nevertheless, one has to understand you cannot do very much unless the economy is expanding. And economic expansion, growth, these are a premium to the Mandela government. And they're trying, no doubt, to provide more services and more investment for the poorer sections of the community. I think this kind of balancing between growth and redistribution as a gradualist approach is something that is important that ought to be learned. There are other things one could mention. Land reform is being looked into. Most important, education for the younger generation, because education is far and away the single most important investment that one can make in the younger generation. This a kind of gradualist, realistic and hard-nosed approach is something that we could learn from, including in other countries that are richer, which are less less prudent in this approach.
Do you think people have the patience for this gradual economic growth?
So far, they have shown exceeding patience in South Africa. Whether this is going to hold or not, I do not know. It might well be that there will be people who will convince sections of the population that they should take to the streets, and one can understand these kind of sentiments. But as long as they see a great sense of sincerity in the leadership, as long as they see an element of sacrifice in the leadership, as long as it is explained to them and they're consulted in it, I think there will be hope. But more than that, one has to understand that the government must always balance its promise with a certain amount of action. There ought to be, at the very least, some minimum programs in education, in housing, and so on. So even if not everything is done, as long as the public sees that the government is trying its best, given the constraints of the time, they'll keep faith with it. It's too early, I think, to tell whether the government will actually live up to these sort of even minimalist expectations.
You talked about South Africa being a model in grooming future leaders for the continent, mm-hmm. and that's been a real problem in many African, especially in the sub-Saharan African countries, of probably its potential leaders leaving the continent because mm-hmm. of the problems that they've faced and the lack of opportunity. What can be done to halt this brain drain? And maybe you could mm-hmm. talk a little bit about just how serious mm-hmm. The problem of brain drain is.
Wherever you get a dictatorship, wherever you get the ruining of institutions, lack of respect for the rule of law, lack of respect for professionalism, honesty, and complete disregard of playing by the rules, you get a drain of good people. They go to countries where the skills are appreciated, they go to institutions where they're well paid, they go to places which are more stable and where they feel that they're being paid their worth. In some cases, these people leave these countries because they're fleeing for their lives, literally, or because their friends have been punished, jailed, and so on. This is what you see in Kenya, this is what you see in Zaire, in Togo, etc. Or the Sudan, war-afflicted countries, Somalia, etc. As of 3 years ago, the statistics are show something like 100,000 skilled people from the African continent who have left the region to work in Europe, in North America, in the Gulf, in international organizations around the world. And oddly enough, an inflow of about the same number of people, 98,000 or so, experts from Europe mostly, but also from America and Canada and Asia, working in Africa. So you see, what you're seeing here is an attempt by the outside world to help, provide skills and technical assistance and so on, in a very unstable environment in which local people and local skills cannot stay. I see it essentially as a political problem before it's even an economic problem. There has to be political stability, there has to be a government that people can trust, there has to be institutions that are working, that people must be made to feel secure and appreciated before they can bring in their skills. This, again, is sort of, you know, almost elementary common sense. But you have governments in the African continent that are mendacious and completely unappreciating, people that rule by the gun and by intimidation, and, you know, we're basically looking after themselves. It's a pity, but this is the cause of the brain drain. Having said that, let me say this, that again, every picture of gloom in Africa must be counterbalanced with what is going right. In countries that have restored political stability and where the economy is flourishing and where sensible professional management of the economy has been introduced and is working, you are seeing a return of the skills. People come back. Talk to people who are outside in the rest of the world. Given an opportunity, they'll gladly go back. They're not happy being exiled. They're not happy walking away from their families and from a home environment and from a culture they know. And so if you look at countries like Ghana, if you look at South Africa itself, Namibia, even Uganda, which used to be a byword for political instability and violence, you're seeing a return of indigenous skills and talent and qualified people. So once we know the formula, chances that you can turn this around very quickly is always there.
You yourself left your native Kenya to come and study in the United States. Mm. What prompted you to leave, and then what made you turn around and decide to go back?
Well, I left to study in the United States as a graduate student in the 70s. At that time, anybody who got an opportunity to study abroad was looking forward to going back immediately. And we all went back. I went back within a week of submitting my doctorate and having it approved. And we were all looking back to going to the country.
It's a very optimistic period.
Very optimistic period, helping out promote growth and development. I taught for 12 years at the local university, University of Nairobi. I taught with complete dedication in difficult circumstances, with a salary that was much, much lower than I would have got in an international organization, or even had I stayed in the United States. I did not for a moment consider that my option was to stay outside. No, it was much, much more personally rewarding to work in my country and work for my people and work for my nation. I do not regret this. When I left, it was because I realized it was a totally hopeless and losing situation, because I do not believe that the Kenya government, as of 1988, when I left the country to go and work for an international organization, the Ford Foundation, was interested in promoting serious and genuine higher education. Quite the contrary, they were placing obstacles to it, arresting lecturers, torturing people, and in general making the university decay. And then what saddened me was that there were some of my colleagues who were quite prepared to join the government in plundering the university, because there were gains to be made from that.
My guest on this edition of Common Ground is Michael Chege, the Executive Director of the Africa Capacity Building Foundation in Zimbabwe. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Please listen at the end of this broadcast for details on ordering. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. The Africa Capacity Building Foundation was created in 1990 with funds from the World Bank, the Africa Development Bank, the UN Development Program, and a number of Western donors and African governments. As executive director of the foundation, Michael Chege says its purpose is for Africans themselves to build on the positive work going on within the continent and not to rely on potentially inappropriate models from outside experts.
I think it's probably a reflection of what we've learned, and I think the donors too, after all, that the solutions must be homegrown. And I think I approach this, this is an approach that I favor and I support.
The idea, African solutions to African problems.
Yes, and the Africans themselves have to look for it. After all, it's their own problem and it's their own mess. It's our own self-destruction that has led to these situations. Admittedly, we have done it with a lot of help from outside.
Mm-hmm. Being a Cold War staging ground pawn.
A Cold War pawn. And also, you know, there are these weapons of destruction and guns and weapons that were passed on conflicting sides from outside. But, you know, you must always understand, you know, nobody forces you to go to war. You know, they may give you the guns, you know, but people kill, not guns. You know? So.
But do you attribute to many of these problems of the past 30 years to the effects of colonialism?
No, I don't.
Why not?
I think that's an argument within. Yeah, I think we have to grow up. And frankly, I think the colonialism as the source of destruction card has been overplayed. Colonialism had terrible consequences on African societies, as did slavery and all the evils of the past. But I'm saying this, we're talking about a whole generation since independence. An awful lot of the things that you're seeing going wrong have been perpetrated on the people after independence by African governments and African leaders. Well, there are some people who argue that, well, there's always the hand of the imperialist behind the scenes somewhere. Conspiracy theories are popular in Africa. I don't believe this, that there's a hidden hand of mendacious outsiders somewhere. On the contrary, I think the interest of the world in Africa has declined tremendously, particularly beginning here, right here in the United States. It's minimal. It's inconsequential. Africa has become, once again, a curiosity. And not just a curiosity, but a very, very scary curiosity. This is, we're just talking about Kaplan and the Coming Anarchy, which was published by the Atlantic Monthly last year. This is the vision of the apocalypse.
Right, in Africa being the harbinger of what's going to happen.
What's going to happen the rest
throughout
of the world.
World.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes, that is a very scary scenario. Mm-hmm. Well, what about political boundaries that were set up in the 19th and 20th century by the colonial powers? With a few exceptions, those boundaries have stayed in place. Should those boundaries be erased? Can they be erased?
I believe for the most part, those boundaries ought to stay. The founding fathers of African nationalism in the 1960s decided that, irrational as they were, these boundaries ought to be respected in both domestic and international law as the only way to go ahead. Because if you started tinkering with them, you'd be opening up a Pandora's box, and you never really know where to begin because there are communities on different sides and of these boundaries and so on. So let's, you know, we decided that you proceed with them, even though we're small countries and countries that may not look viable in the short run. That, in any case, it was a good point to begin. Is it possible to change these boundaries? I'm beginning to see evidence that in some cases that will be done.
And has happened.
In the case of Eritrea, mm-hmm. it's a fait accompli that a new country has been born or has been created out of Ethiopia. And after a 30-year bloody war of secession, in some cases I'm now convinced that the only way to get a respite from continuous bloodletting and truly, truly inhuman suffering is to change boundaries. We may begin by looking at our own internal boundaries, and I've always been an advocate of a much more decentralized form of government, which allows for a certain amount of local autonomy and greater responsibilities to local communities. That means sort of some tinkering with internal boundaries and giving them, if not geographical, at least some political fiscal autonomy. Even federalism, by the way, genuine federalism, as long as it does not derogate from respect of individual rights, the right to live anywhere, to own property anywhere, and not to have your rights violated simply because you don't speak the same language, the same culture as your neighbor. This, by the way, it's a well-known factor in the federalist United States, for example, is one.
In the U.S. press and in much of the world press, I think the violence, the wars that have taken place in Africa in recent years have been attributed to tribalism, and I know that's a phrase that you are very much opposed to. And first, I'd like to talk about your objections to that. I think on the face, it's pretty obvious, but maybe we need to have a little bit of education here.
I object to the use of tribalism in Africa as sort of primordial, old-fashioned, primitive sort of emotive, visceral hatred of one group for another. It evokes memories of African tribes with spears and coming out and butchering each other mindlessly. I don't think that this is what is happening in Africa. In Europe, we have ethnic identities and have had for a long time. In Africa, basically, when you're talking about tribalism, you're talking about ethnic identities. Mm-hmm. Identities that are created by human beings and that have,
exist the world over.
And it's just the same as the world over. And we have an ethnic global problem. Let's be honest about this and treat it as such. If we can get our psychological hang-ups put on the side and begin to see ethnicity as a global problem, more or less, more intense in some countries than in others, we might perhaps be in a position where we have gone beyond the mountaintop and we are seeing some evidence, some reality to the problem, and therefore we can formulate solutions. Do you want to tell me that what's happening in Yugoslavia, in the Caucasus, in parts of Asia like Sri Lanka, you see elements of this now in Pakistan. You see elements of this in Europe, a resurgence of ethnic identity, even in Britain itself, or Scotland, or even Quebec. Now look, we have a problem that ethnicity as an enduring factor in national politics in different countries will be there, will always be with us. The United States used to boast of itself as a melting pot. We know, since Nathan Glaze and Patrick Moynihan did their study of New York, that in the 1960s, that in fact ethnic identities in Africa, in the United States, actually continue and are an important reference point for local groups. It does not lead to the disintegration of the country, and this is the point that you want to make, that ethnic identity can be harnessed to be a positive force in national development. And that people can have an identity of ethnicity, of culture, an ethnic pride, but still be loyal to the country, loyal to the government, and be honest, temperate, patriotic citizens. It is possible to be both.
Very delicate balance, too.
It's a very delicate
balance. Here in the U.S., even.
Yeah. And so what one has to do is always work towards balancing that delicate and educating the people about it. Those within an ethnic group, and those outside it, so that they can understand that to some extent you can have ethnic culture and ethnic pride, but only up to a point where it does not begin to destroy or to subtract from the loyalty to the bigger nation, which the country to survive, you must always have. And I think this is an international problem. We must begin looking at it after the Cold War, especially. Because look, all these problems you're reading about, Russia and Chechnya and so on, it's a serious problem. And you're seeing destruction of peoples, of innocent people, of innocent lives. It's come to haunt us because perhaps we ignored it for a long time.
Do you see democracy as Africa's future?
It is Africa's future because the people say so. They say so because they turn out to vote. You looked at the turnout in South Africa and you saw those winding lines. These are people who have never voted before in their lives. Many of them do not have a college diploma. They don't have a high school diploma. And yet, you give them a chance and you're seeing a voter turnout that put the U.S. to shame. In Mozambique, the turnout was something like 90%. A country that is, whose rate of literacy is something like 20-30%. In the United States, if you get a voter turnout of 55%, that's very high. So please, let's be clear about this. I don't want intellectuals and theorists to be the judge, and I don't want the dispute among us as leaders or rulers and the UN and the big... Let's say this, let the people make that decision. And every time they've been given a choice and told, you choose whoever you want, they have turned out in droves. Who are we to say no? So we might have, and in classrooms, always the debate whether democracy applies universally or it is just a Western phenomenon and so on. But the test, the acid test, in my view, has always been, what do the people say?
What are the most important elements to democratization in Africa? Is it economic reform? Is that the the closest link to democratization, and so that people have a sense of economic security?
No, I don't think it's economics. The biggest correlate to democracy, if you ask me, is a civic culture, a civic community spirit. We've just been talking about allegiance to the greater whole as opposed to the individual or the individual community. The cultivation of a civic culture, a culture that tolerates the differences, a culture that believes in open debate, the avoidance of a culture of confrontation and violence, the elevation of violence to a means of settling communal and civic dispute is one of the greatest problems that we have to be overcome. I believe that we have seen societies in Africa that are poor but have had a democratic tradition of consensus, consultation, and respect of differences of opinion. On the other hand, you have seen cases where violence and confrontation and hatred, including ethnic hatred and racial hatred, has become a way of life, and I think that is something that you want to minimize. And again, I'm saying this is not just an Africa problem, it's a global problem, you know, if we are to be serious about this. And I already see some encouraging work in scholarship and in writing that is beginning to address this as a universal problem, and this is useful. So economic growth in the long run is obviously one of the best anchors and foundations of democracy, because if people are economically secure, then they will not want to fight each other and so on. But I'm not convinced that economic growth and property ownership and of in and of itself is a sufficient condition for democracy. You need economic growth, yes, but you need the civic spirit, civic community. You need the capacity to tolerate one another as a moralizing, as an organizing morality before all else.
Well, the whole topic of economic growth, we could do another half hour on, and so we'll stop right here. But I thank you very much, Michael Chege.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest on Common Ground has been Michael Chege, the Executive Director of the Africa Capacity Building Foundation in Zimbabwe. For Common Ground, I'm Mary Gray Davidson. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9530, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Ask for program number 9530. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free at 1-800-825-5746. And if you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comments about the program, write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa. The zip code is 52761. And again, that toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by DJ Lederman. Common Ground is produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.